Chatodino Elena from Shakol, and the other from Amen.
Jared, just for you.
So we're both saying we're here on Daf Lamed Aleph. Lamed Aleph. And the Gemara has a kind of a sad story to tell.
No.
About an elderly woman. And it seems that the Reish Galusa had a bunch of servants. He was the head of the Golus, and they actually, whether deliberately or hopefully inadvertently, stole trees from this elderly woman. And they used the trees to make a sukkah. So let's see if we can find the Gemara Hahi Savta. So we're on Daf Lamed Aleph, Lamed Aleph. And if you count down from the top, what would you say? It's about 12 lines? Something like that? So the first one in the line is Hu, if that helps anybody.
Hu Ahu.
Right. And we're going to start with Hahu. 15.
It's the 15th line.
Hahi. Okay, we'll start with Hahi. So you have Hu and Hahi. Hahi Savta. So we're talking about an elderly woman. The word Savta can sometimes mean a grandmother in modern Hebrew, but in ancient Hebrew or in Aramaic, it really means a zkena. And the servants of the Reish Galusa stole her trees, her wood, and they used it for schach. The asoy lekame de Rav Nachman, and she comes to complain in front of Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman was the posek at that time. Amro le, so she says to Rav Nachman, Reish Galusa, v'kulu rabbanan to be Reish Galusa. Not only is the Reish Galusa, but all the rabbis, these Talmidei Chachamim that are sitting in this sukkah, b'sukkah gzula haviyasve. They're sitting in a stolen sukkah because my trees, my wood was stolen and was used for the schach. This is a pretty remarkable case. Might have been splashed on the front covers of the local rag.
Scandal.
A scandal, right. A real scandal. And Vitzavcha Velo Ashkech Bar Rav Nachman. And even though she was yelling and screaming, complaining as it were that she wants her trees, her wood back, but Rav Nachman pays no attention to her. Very sad story. Amra Le, so she says to Rav Nachman, because she's, shall we say, a little bit insulted here. What's going on? He's not paying attention. She has a real claim. And she speaks about herself now in third person. She says, Issa, a woman, the Havile La Avua, that her father had, and apparently she inherited from her father, Tlas Mea Vitamni Srei Avdi. That's 300, Tlas, right? Tlas is Shalosh. Shalosh Meos, 300. Tamni Srei is always a teen, and Tamni is the number 8, so she has 318 Avdi. She inherits 318 slaves from her father. And Rashi and other Mefarshim say that this was a symbolic reference to her forefather, her ancient forefather, her ancestor Avram Avinu. That actually Avram Avinu had 318 Avodim. Because the Pasuk says in Parshas Lech Lecha, it says over there, Vayorek es Chanichov. You remember that Avram Avinu goes out to battle against 5 great kings, and he gathers together his battalion, and the Torah tells you exactly how many members there were in his battalion. Yelidei Beso, the Torah says, Shmona Saru Shlosh Meos, 318. So it's not just coincidental that she claims that she inherited 318 slaves from her father. This is her forefather, her ancestor, Avram Avinu. Now, the Gemara in Nedarim claims that Avram Avinu really didn't go out to battle with 318 soldiers. He only had one soldier. Who was that?
Eliezer.
Because Eliezer, Begmatria, is 318. And that's one of the rare cases that the Gemara builds an interpretation of a Pasuk in Chumash on a Gematria. Gematria is usually reserved for Chassidish or Rebbeim and more mystical thinking. You know, in this case, the Gematria dates back to the time of the Gemara. And it's very interesting that the number 318 is one beyond 317. Does anybody know the significance of the number 317? So for this, let's see if we have... Oh, look at this. This is really sophisticated. Okay. How do you say to despair in Lashon Kodesh?
Yeah.
Okay, let's see what happens here. So this is 10, 1, this is 6, and this is 300.
Wow.
317, am I right?
Yeah.
So Eliezer represents one beyond Yesh. Wow. He goes beyond despair. And that's called Elkei Avi Be'ezri. That's why his name is about the help of God, and he's not going to give up, even though it's against all odds. Imagine a one-man soldier going to battle the four greatest kings in that time. And anyway, she's claiming that she has credentials. You know, that she really is an important woman. She's a daughter of Avraham Avinu, or perhaps the daughter of a very rich father. And you're not Vitzovcha, and I'm yelling and screaming Kamaichu in your presence. She talks to him in a plural, Kamaichu, even though she's talking to one person, to Rav Nachman, Veloachke Chisube, and you're not paying any attention. Why is that so? Amaluhu Rav Nachman. So at that point, Rav Nachman turns to the rabbis that are sitting in the sukkah, the stolen sukkah, and he says about this woman, Pa'isa hi, duh. This woman, duh, this woman is a Pa'isa. Pa'isa, Rashi and the Mefarshim say, means kolanit. Kolanit means a woman who likes to raise her voice and yell and scream. So it could be that Rav Nachman had a history with this woman. We don't know exactly in the past what situations she may have raised her voice against Rav Nachman. But now legufo shalinyan, as we'd say, in other words, let's relate to the essence of the issue here. Are we sitting in a stolen sukkah? So Rav Nachman says there's no basis for her claim that this sukkah is invalid. Why? The Gemara says, "V'ein la ela d'mei eitzim bilvat," that all she has the right to claim are the value, the monetary value for compensation for these trees, this wood. In other words, you evaluate on the market, you bring in an assessor, and he's going to determine exactly what the value on the market is and what monies you could bring in if you would sell these trees, this wood. And now we have to ask the following question. Why is this so? Why does Rav Nachman think that she has no recourse to get back her trees? After all, they stole her trees. So one possibility is to say that they, meaning the Gazlan, in this case the servants of the Reish Galusa, they made a kinyan, they acquired ownership over these trees. Now, normally to acquire ownership on trees, you need what's called Shinui Masa. Shinui Masa means that you have to change the structure of the object. So for example, if a Gazlan steals raw wheat, natural wheat, or grains in its natural state, and then he grinds it and he converts it into flour, that's called a Shinui Masa. However, in this case, could you apply the principle of Shinui Masa? Has the Gazlan made any radical change, or shall we say, irreversible change? Remember that? It's got to be a shinui she'eino chozel b'yoso. It can't be replaced. That's supposed to binding the three minim. Did they, these servants who stole her trees, did they make an irreversible change in the trees, in the wood?
You have to, because if it's mechubar l'karka, the trees were obviously
mechubar l'karka. No, they're not. It's not mechubar l'karka. See, that's the difference between the word eitzim and the word karka. Menachem is asking the following question. If these trees are growing in the ground, and then the gazlonim came and they cut down the trees, so that would be a shinui masa. That would mean that you change the structure of the wood, because before it was growing in the ground, and now it was changed. But the word eitzim in this Gemara, and we had this in the last Gemara that we studied, means something different. Eitzim means that it's already been cut down. And therefore, there's no radical change in the... But now we have a different kind of an acquisition. That's called a shinui shem. What's a shinui shem?
Change of name.
Excellent. Change of name. A name change. Remember, we called it a passport name change. And how do you change the name of an object? By designating it for a mitzvah. Once it's designated for a mitzvah, it now takes on a new name. You don't call it Eitzim anymore. What is it called?
Schach.
Excellent. It's called Schach. So on one level, we could say that what Rav Nachman is claiming over here is that she has no recourse to get back her wood because the Gazlan already made a kinyan. He already acquired ownership on the wood. And in the best case scenario, she has recourse to get what?
Money.
Money, exactly, the compensation.
Why not kefal?
Kefal is only in the case of a ganav. A ganav is someone who sneaks into your house, he doesn't face you, and there's no encounter in which you see him, he does it stealthily, and he has to pay kefal. We're talking now about a gazlan, who in clear daybreak, you know, daylight, he steals something from you. And that's how she knew exactly where her trees were. So in the worst case scenario, she can only get back from the Gazlan, or in the best case scenario, she can only get back Karen. What's called Karen means the principal, the actual value. Why can't she get back the wood itself? If the wood hasn't changed its state, it still looks the same. So one approach, as we said, is to say that the Gazlan made a kinyan, he acquired ownership on the object that was stolen based on what we call Shinui Hashem, although there's no physical change in the object, but its designation changes the name that you give to the object. But Rashi indicates here that there's a whole nother logical reason why she has no rights to get back the tree itself. Okay? So this is going to introduce a concept which is called Takonas Marish. Okay, men? There's no way possible that you'll remember this unless you write it down and memorize it and repeat it 3 times a day for the next 25 years. Anyway, what is a takonas marish? Marish is another word for a beam, B-E-A-M, okay, which is something that's used... did I spell that right? B-E-A-M, okay. Yeah. And it's something that's used in the structure of a building. And takana means to enact a new takana. The Torah says that if you steal someone's beams and you use them in a structure, you build them, if you're a kablan, as we say, or I didn't mean to say a dirty word. Anyway, if you're a no, just kidding. Anyway, if you're a kablan and you take this marish is the Aramaic word for a beam, a korah in Hebrew, okay? So the Hebrew Lashon Kodesh, for those who are in Ulpan, or think you're going to Ulpan, I get Ulpan credit here, is called a korah. And in Aramaic, it's called a marish, okay? And this marish was subject to a very long and profound takana in which Chazal said they wanted somehow to encourage the Gazlan to offer paying money for the gzela, meaning that he would somehow confess his crime at some point when the evidence started piling up, but we don't have enough evidence against him. And what would motivate him to come forward with a confession and pay the value of what he stole in the case of a beam, it would be the Takonas Marish. And the Takonas Marish says that he doesn't have to take apart the building. He doesn't have to be mefarek, as we call it, how would you say in English, lefarek?
Disassemble.
Yeah, but there's a word. Disassemble, maybe? Disassemble, if there's such a word. To disassemble the structure. We're going to let him keep the beams, the marish that he stole, all for the sake of the greater good that he'll come forward, because if you're going to tell him that, you know what, if you admit and confess your crime, you're going to have to take apart this structure. That's a tremendous tircha meaning a lot of work and effort. He doesn't want to do that. So to give him a little bit extra of a push to finally come forward and admit, confess his crime, and then he'll only have to pay the value of this wood, of these beams. So we told him, you know what? You can keep the beams. You can hold on to them, and there's no chiyuv hashom. You don't have to return the beams themselves. All you have to do is pay for it and compensate. That's called takonas marish. So again, let's just review. There are two ways of understanding Rav Nachman. Why did Rav Nachman say to this issusa, to this elderly woman, sahi savta, that she has no claim on the wood itself? One approach is to say that once that wood was used as schach, the Gazlan now effectuated an acquisition, a kinyan, on the wood, because it now changed its name, it became schach, it's no longer called Eitzim, now it's called schach. And the other approach, which seems to be the approach of most Rishonim, is that even if you would argue that this shinui would not be enough for the Gazlan to acquire ownership. The Rabbanon, the rabbis, made an enactment to Takana. And by the way, how could the Rabbanon do such a thing? If the Torah says that she, as the Nigzal, she has rights to get her wood back, how did the Rabbanon have the authority to cut her off from her trees, so to speak? Anybody know what that's called? That's called Hefker. Anybody?
Beitin Hefker.
Excellent. Hefker, Beitin Hefker. Which means that the rabbis, the question is how and why, this is a Gemara Givamas, the Gemara says that the rabbis are absolutely authorized to take something that belongs to you and remove your ownership on it. Which is amazing. Like, for example, okay, I don't want to get off on a tangent, but in any event, so this is the authority of the rabbis. Yeah, Ben?
I'm just wondering, what is the agenda of bringing this Agadata if it just mirrors the Sugya and the Shakal Tai that we already came with?
Well, you see, we never really touched on this case of Takanas Marish. In other words, we've been speaking about a machlokes between Rabbi Eliezer and the Rabbanon as to whether or not a stolen sukkah can be used for the mitzvah of sukkah. And if you recall, Rav Nachman made a distinction between throwing someone out of his sukkah, and that's how you steal his sukkah, as opposed to the case where you stole wood and you used the wood to make a sukkah. And now Rav Nachman is illustrating that, halacha l'maisa, meaning as an actual practical ruling, we're going to see that the great rabbis of that period of time fulfilled their mitzvah of sukkah with a sukkah that was stolen. But again, what was stolen, everybody?
The wood.
If the wood was stolen, that's a different story.
Why does Rashi give us this Takanta Moresh idea if everyone's agreed, if all the Rabbanan and Rabbi Eliezer and everyone is okay with the stolen wood, why do we even need...
You mean if there's Shini, Hashem, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, so Shini Hashem is a sugya Masechta Bava Kama. The Gemara goes back and forth exactly what kind of a name change has to be effectuated in order to create a kinyan. Like, for example, very often Shini Hashem implies that there's some physical change in the object that lends itself to a different name. You remember we had the case where you stole Hadassim and you bind it together with the Lulav and the Arova, and it changed its name from a Hadass to what? Who remembers? Hoshana. Hoshana, correct. And there you did do a physical change of some sort. Again, the physical change per se, which is called Shini Masa, would not have been enough because it's a Shini Achozel Biyoso. It's not irreversible, it's reversible. But nevertheless, you made a physical change, and as a result of that physical change, you also altered the name of the thing. In this case, the Gemara thinks, according to that sheet in the Rishonim, there wasn't enough of a profound change from Eitzim to Schach to be considered Shini Hashem.
So the servants that stole the wood, they do have to pay?
Yeah, they have to pay the compensation. Correct.
So in Rav Nachman's approach, why is there no disincentive for the Gemara?
Disincentive. Let me just take apart what you say.
Something to dissuade him from doing it in the future. Just that he paid for it. It's equivalent. Payment is equivalent to the tree, to the branch.
Well, how do we dissuade a person from criminal activity? I mean, that's a very basic question, halacha. For example, a gazlan is posseliedus. I mean, that's for one. Again, it goes way beyond that, which means that a gazlan cannot testify in a court of law. He has to undergo a whole process of tshuva. And there are many other what's the opposite of incentive? You call them disincentives? Okay.
No, harta.
Yeah, how do you say harta in English? Deterrence. Excellent. That's the word I was looking for. Thanks, Jerry. See, it paid for you to come just to help me out looking for the word deterrent. Okay, Richard. So there are many deterrents in halacha that would inhibit a person, if we could use that word, from doing a criminal act.
It was a different mentality in those days. I don't think we can fathom.
Right. We're also worried, keep in mind, about a case of a shogeg. You remember we discussed a storage house, and many people use the storage house. So Reuven has his wood in this section in the north, and Shimon in the south. And sometimes they confused it, and instead of walking away, you know, he was working on behalf of, in this case, the Reish Galusa, and instead of walking out with his wood, he walked out with somebody else's wood, in this case, this old lady, Hahi Savta. Okay, let's begin Ravina. Omer Ravina. Kishura demetaltala digzula. In the case of a beam that was stolen, and then it was used to create a structure, for example, a sukkah, avdile rabbanan takanta. The rabbanan made a takana. And that takana was that he doesn't have to take apart his building, his structure, his sukkah, in order to return the beam. Mishum takonas morish. So again, it could be that Rav Nachman himself, in the previous Gemara that we learned, was built on this statement of Ravina. And this is called takonas morish. And now the Gemara says that, is there a difference between two words? One word is called kishura, and the other word is called Eitzim. So until now, you may notice that we've been talking about Eitzim. We've been talking about wood. Kshura is a beam. The difference is that wood can be placed on the top of a structure as a kind of quasi-ceiling, especially if your structure is what we call a budka, meaning it's a temporary structure like a sukkah, which you're going to take apart after 7 days. Kshura, on the other hand, indicates a beam that's actually built in a permanent way into a structure. It's a building beam. That's called a kshura. So the Gemara says, pshita. The Gemara says, why is Ravina bothering telling me something that I know? After all, the whole sugi that we learned previously is built on the fact that there is such an institution called takanas marish. So the Gemara answers, and the Gemara says, Maishno mi eitzim. Why would I think it's different than trees, which was the case that we had before, where the Avadim stole the trees of this Issa, and we applied the principle of Takaris Marish. Ma'oditem, I would have thought, Eitzim Shchichi. Eitzim is replaceable, meaning there's a market, there's an availability in the market of Eitzim. You want to buy wood? Just go to the market and buy wood. So the Chachamim say, you know what? If a person loses their wood, again on a Doraisa level, according to Torah law, the person, the nigzal, the victim has rights and recourse to get back his wood. But the Rabbanan wanted, as we said before, give an incentive to the gazlan. So they alleviated the gazlan of his responsibility to take apart this structure in order to return the wood. That's in a case of wood, of eitzim. Why? Because the Rabbanan are not so concerned about the position of the Nigzal. Once the Gazlan pays the value of the Eitzim, all the Nigzal has to do is walk up the block, so to speak, and find a local market and purchase Eitzim to replace the Eitzim that were gone. Aval hai, but this case of a Kshura, lo shchicha, it seems that it was quite a to-do in order to replace something called Kshura. The Ema lo, and therefore I would have thought, Ema means Ahavamina, it would have crossed my mind lo that there was no Takonas Chachamim of Marish in the case of something where the Nigzal is going to take such a loss that in order for him to get back his Korah, his beams, he's got to find a beam seller. You know, that's not very common. You know, even in today's day, by the way, you know, there's a whole manufacturing industry to take wood and make beams out of them. So therefore, would the Rabbanon differentiate when they made this takonis marish between A, something that's very easily replaced, just give you currency, cold cash, and you could simply buy it in the local market, as opposed to B, something that is so much rare, so much more complicated to replace? Kamash Malon, and this is the Chiddush of Ravina, that Ravina wants to say that even if you take something and it's very hard to replace it. You stole a kshura, which is not something that's common, that's easily located, and you take the money and just order a kshura. You know, today you could go online and order, you know, all the kshura. Even in that case, the Rabbanon instituted a takonas marish.
So the end result is the same.
Oh, not exactly. That's what's, hold your breath for just 1 second. But Hani really says the Gemara, when do we apply this logic that the Chachamim will institute Takonas Morish, even the case of a beam that's being used for the building of a sukkah? That's bigo. Okay, that's an important word. Bigo. Anybody know how to translate the word bigo? Because you'll see this all over the place. So I want to write it down. Bigo means on the inside. Bitoch. Okay, in Hebrew this would be bitoch. Now, bitoch could either mean a location or a time period. Either it's inside something physically. Like, you know, let's say, for example, this cup is bigo, this kara, right? It's inside the kara. Or bigo could mean it's in a time framework. And that's what it means here. Bigo shiva. Meaning that as far as the Rabbanan are concerned, they're going to say that, you know what, during the seven days of the Chag, we are going to allow the Gazlan to maintain ownership over this kshura. And the reason for that is because he needs to sit in the sukkah. And he's not taking apart his sukkah. So we, again, if we force him to take apart his sukkah, maybe he's not going to come forward and be so magnanimous, so to speak, and admit his and confess his crime. Avalabas or shiva, but after the 7 days pass by, hadar means you return, be'ene means in its original state, the eitzim themselves. Why? Because anyway he's going to take apart his sukkah. What do we do after sukkahs? We take it apart. So he's going to take apart at least the schach. You know, some people leave their sukkah on the whole year round, but at least they take the schach, because otherwise it gets ruined with the rainy season. So in any event, this Gazlan is going to take apart his sukkah, and he has the eitzim in front of him that he stole and he used for the sukkah, and now return them. So basically what we're saying is that under certain circumstances, the Hahi Savta, that elderly lady, does have recourse to get back her Eitzim. We're going to push her off during the 7 days of the Chag, but we're going to tell her to show up when? After the Chag, and reclaim her wood, and in such a case she can get it back. But even this is going to be conditional. But the E Chibro Betina, if the Gazlan went ahead and he connected that wood, Betina, Tina means cement. In Hebrew it's called tit, tet, yud, tet. You know, that's when you mix dirt with water and you do what's called gibel. Gibel means when you knead it together with a K, knead it together, and it becomes a new substance. As long as it's wet, you can use it to cement something. So if the Gazlan went ahead and he took this wood, and he cemented it down, presumably not as schach, because are we allowed to cement down schach?
No,
because that makes it into a permanent structure. But let's say he uses the beams as defanos, meaning as the walls of his sukkah. Now, if he went ahead and he cemented them down, then afil yachar shiva, even after the 7 days of chag pass, nami also yoyevle, he gives her, meaning the Gazlan has to return to the Nigzal Dmei. What does Dmei mean?
The
value. The financial value on the market, because we're not going to expect of him to have to take apart a permanent structure. Now it becomes included in Takonis Marish. So let's just summarize, and then Don, you'll ask your question. So here's the summary of what we have. 3 points. Point number one is that Ravina wants to tell us a big chiddush, that Takonis Marish applies in the case of a Marish, even if it's a very expensive and rare object that's very difficult to replace. And if it was taken and used as a sukkah, Ravina says the sukkah is kshera. Then Ravina makes point number two. It's true that Takonis Marish will apply even in the case of a beam at the expense of the nigzal, if that beam is being used as part of a sukkah, and now the nigzal is going to be very hard pressed to try to replace those beams. Nevertheless, the nigzal only has recourse to get what? To get its value. Now we get to point number three. Says Ravina, however, even Takonis Marish has a limitation. And that is, in the case of sukkah, if it's very expectable, if we can anticipate that the stolen sukkah will be taken apart after 7 days, then takonis marish doesn't apply, and the owner of the trees, of the wood, has the right to say after 7 days, I want my wood back. I'm not going to settle for a replacement. Why? Because in this case, by its very nature, the wood is going to be disassembled. It's going to be taken apart, and there's no reason why in this case we should apply takonis marish. However, if the wood, these beams, were actually built into the structure, and how do I determine if they're built into the structure in a permanent way?
Can't take it apart.
And why can't you take it apart, Don? What do they use?
Cement.
Tina. What's Tina? Cement, actually. When you use cement, then, again, the takonis marish is going to apply. So we really went through three stages over here. In the first stage, we said, well, takonis marish shouldn't apply because it's so complicated and so much of a hassle on the behalf of the nigzal to try to replace these beams. That was stage number one. So we thought maybe we shouldn't apply takonis marish. Comes along Ravina and he says no. In the balance, we're going to tip the scale in favor of encouraging and giving an incentive to the gazlan to come forward and confess his crime. And even in the case of a korah, we're going to allow him to keep the korah and ask him to simply replace it with currency. However, in the case of a sukkah, the story is a little different. Because since anyway the gazlan is going to take apart the sukkah when? At the end of the 7 day period. Therefore, we can expect of him and demand of him that he pay back and return the eitzim, and we're going to suspend the application of what? Of takonis marish. However, if he stole this korah and he built it into the structure of the sukkah in such a way that it's going to be a tremendous hassle for him to take apart the sukkah, he already cemented this wood into the structure of his sukkah in a permanent way, he used it for the defilus of the sukkah, and he's going to use it next year and the year after, and so forth and so on, then in that case we will apply takonis marish even in the case of a sukkah. Don?
Yeah, fine.
Okay.
So what happens in the instance where the staff that comes over and sees that her expensive beams are in his sukkah, and she says, okay, you know, I'm going to wait until after sukkah's over.
She has the right to do it.
He can't pay her cash value.
Right.
Then.
She has a right to rescind her claim.
Yep.
And, so to speak, put it into deep freeze.
And come back.
And that's this is a basic principle in what's called Toein V'Nitan. You know, it's a whole section in Shulchan Aruch we could probably spend a couple of years on it called Hilchas Toein V'Nitan. And one of the fundamental principles in Hilchas Toein V'Nitan is that if a claimant decides to suspend his claim until he can gather together more evidence or other benefits that he might gain by waiting, he has the right to do so. Michael?
I'm very disappointed in this takonis marish. I mean, it's a thief's charter. I mean, basically, you know, you want some wood, right. So you've got a choice. Either you can got the hassle of going, finding a shop that sells wood and going there and parking and cleaning up, or you just go
I
to,
see
or
you're an Israeli worried about parking.
you just go into your neighbor's garden, just take the wood. And what's the worst that can happen? You have to pay for it.
Well, look, you know, there's an issue here about weighing, you know, the pros and the cons. You know, on the one hand, we don't want to make it easy for the gazlan and give him an incentive to steal. But on the other hand, for those few people, hopefully the few, although there is a Gemara that does seem to indicate, I don't want to say it out loud here because Rav Levi Braditcheva would get me upset, you know, get upset about it. But there is one Gemara that seems to assume that stealing and theft was quite common. I assume there were different periods of time in Jewish history. Have you ever heard of a statement in the Gemara that says Rov Ganva Yisrael? Anyway, that's a pretty heavy accusation.
I'm not surprised.
Yes. But let's assume during a normal period of Jewish history when there's not so much theft going on, and it's very fascinating, the Mashgiach of Lakewood Yeshiva, I don't know if you heard of him, he's a Brit, his name is Rav Solomon. And he has a whole essay on one word in the Vidui that we say, some have the minhag to say it daily, but we'll say it as Ashkenazim on Yom Kippur over and over again. Gazalnu. That's the gimel of Hashamnu Bagadnu Gazalnu. And he asks the question, why are we, you know, every last Jew, rank and file Jew, is getting up on Yom Kippur, clapping Gazalnu. I mean, Ribbono Shel Olam. Well, are we all guilty of gzela? So he has a very long presentation to show that gzela has many different subtle applications. It's not, you know, where I just put my hand into your pocket and I take out your wallet. You know, there are many different forms of gzela. It's a beautiful essay. If you're ever interested, let me know. I can photocopy it for you or lend you the book. I have the book. He's one of the most influential mashgichim in the world today. Does anybody have a clue how many students study in Lakewood Yeshiva?
5,000.
Over 5,000. And he's the mashgiach for 5,000 students. Now that's nothing compared to the Mir up the block here. I happen to know from the inside that the Mir has 9,000 students. It's like a city unto itself. And I don't know if in Jewish history we ever had such a thing. Honestly. In any event, so we're balancing, you know, I don't want to get off too much on a tangent, we can discuss this after the shiur, but, you know, we're balancing the pros and the cons here of Takanis Marish, which is, by the way, a major sugya, Masechta Bava Kama. We're only seeing the tippy tip of it as far as it relates to a sukkah that was stolen, and the wood of the sukkah was used to build the sukkah, either the schach or the tfanos. And Chazal made this Takana in order to suspend the hashavas hagzela, the obligation of the gazan to return the object for the sake of an incentive that he should come forward if he built, you know, if he took these beams and he built them into a structure he'd rather not even come forward because the whole structure is going to be disassembled. Well, just one second, Mendel, and you're on board. I just want to say one last thing. Correct. Now, we always have to keep one thing in mind. Takanas Marish does not undermine the Chiyuv Hashava. It only changes the nature of the Chiyuv Hashava. Meaning, the Torah says the following. If Reuven steals from Shimon, so obviously as long as the object that was stolen is still be'en, it's still intact, then Reuven the Gazan has to return the object to Shimon. But if the object is destroyed, let's say it goes up in smoke, there still is a chiyuv of Ahishev as Akzela. He still has to return the Gzela, albeit in a different form. Namely as what? As currency. What the Rabbanan are doing with the Takanis Marish is they're shifting the nature of the Chiyuv HaShava in those cases where the Gazan stole something and he built it into a permanent structure. What they're saying is that the Chiyuv HaShava does not apply to the Be'en, to the actual object that he stole, which would entail, which would require him to take apart the building, but rather we go to the fallback position of Chiyuv HaShava, namely pay its value. The question is, how far are we going to go? Are we going to go even if it's a beam that's manufactured and that's quite rare? And now again, we have to throw in another variable into the equation. You know, at what, you know, when you shift the Chiyuv HaShava from the Be'en to Damim, to its value, what you're doing is you're really stepping on the feet of the Nigzal, because how's he going to replace these koros? And that was the Chiddush of Ravina. And then Ravina made this stipulation. In the case of a sukkah, we wouldn't apply that unless he actually built it into the structure of the sukkah. Amen.
So it's theoretical. Like this safta, if she had used her wood, either had designated it for skach or had actually put it onto her sukkah, and then they stole it off her sukkah, would that be allowed, or that would be a stolen sukkah?
In other words, once she used the etzim as schach on the sukkah,
yeah,
then what happens? If the gazan comes along and he steals the schach right off the head of the sukkah, that's what you're asking.
Yeah.
So look, in that case, the gazan has not used it as a structure. So then you could ask yourself the following question. Do we apply Takanis Marish? As long as the object is still be'en and it hasn't been built into a structure, then there's no Takanis Marish. If on the other hand, the Gazlan skimmed off, you know, lifted. It's very interesting. In you know, when I was in the army here, they have a word, laharim. Laharim means to steal. But literally, laharim means to lift.
Yeah.
It's a little bit interesting.
Shoplifter.
A shoplifter, right. So it's very interesting because the word laharim in halachic terms, in a context of halacha, means hafrashas truma. Haramas truma. The word truma comes from the shorish laharim. And to borrow that term and use it in the army for those who steal, who meirim li et ha, you know, et ha tziyud, whatever he steals from the guy. But anyway, so if the gazlan just lifted it, and he hasn't yet built it into a structure, then we don't apply Takanis Marish. But once the Gazlan built it into a structure, then he has to pay its value, but he doesn't have to return the object. Now, what did the Gazlan do with the schach? So that's going to be your question. If the Gazlan took the schach and put it on top of his sukkah, yeah. So I'm not going to apply takonis marish until after, except during the 7 days of chag. But after the chag, then if let's say it was your sukkah, you'd have recourse to get back your schach.
It's a bit of a waste. That's what's the point?
Michael, you know the famous story of Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky. Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky was a very important rabbi and a posek in London. Now I think the rabbi that replaced him is Rav Aaron Troy. I don't know if you've heard of him, but way before Rav Aaron Troy was Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky. So there was a case that came up into one of the courts in London, one of the secular courts, in which a Jew was accused of stealing one of the Dalad Minim. I don't remember what he was accused of stealing, that he went into someone's field and he cut down whatever, we'll call it Adasim. I don't know the case. And the judge brought Rabbi Abramsky as like an expert witness kind of thing, because he asked him, you know, are you a very important rabbi here? And he said, yes, I'm a rabbi. So the judge wanted to paskin that the Jew who was holding on to stolen hadassim would have to return those hadassim. So Rav Abramsky said, how do you say kvod ha-shofet, you know, your honor, I guess, the judge. I think the judge was actually wearing a shetel. Is that possible?
Yeah.
Okay. So he said to the judge, judge, you're 1,000% right and your verdict is correct. I will make sure that within a week's time he will return that dust. And then the judge said to Rav Abramsky, what is your position? Because the judge didn't know, he was a non-Jew. So Rav Abramsky said, I'm the chief rabbi. So Rav Abramsky said to him, does that mean you're the expert in London in Jewish law? He said, yes, I am the last final word, I'm the expert. And the judge turned to him and he says, that sounds arrogant. So Rav Abramsky is quoted as saying, I'm under oath. I'm under oath.
I have a question. It's now Sukkah, right? Or the day before Sukkah, right? And the guy took the schach from Reuben. Shimon took it from Reuben and put it on his sukkah, right? Shimon, the guy who lost his schach, right? He has no way to replace it for whatever reason, right? He lives in remote area. Right. These are the only two guys living there. He went 10 miles to get it, brought it, hauled it in, right? And the other guy said, I mean,
he's got to get together a mafia and throw the guy out of the sukkah because he deserves to sit in the sukkah. But what's the status of a stolen sukkah?
He can't demand that he give it back.
What's the status of a stolen sukkah?
Until he repays.
So the answer to that question is the
schach can be replaced.
The schach is the sukkah.
Right. Yeah, all right, but it can be replaced, right? And there's no other schach.
Right. So the answer to the question of a stolen sukkah is going to be the sugya that we want to cover in the next period of time. So if you can hang in there again, I give also another shiur at 11:45, and that's where I get really into
the same idea.
This shiur is meant to be for those who want to learn Gemara, Rashi, and Tosfos. Do you know what I mean? You come to the second shiur too, so you'll hear a lot more about a stolen sukkah, Mirtz Hashem, at 11:45.
I'll wait.
Hopefully by then we'll get the air conditioning working. Or we'll get the window open. Alright. Rabosai, what's the status of a dried up lulav? Well, let's go back to the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, okay, this is back on Chavtes Amid Beis, lulav ha-gozel, a stolen lulav, ve-ha-yovesh, possible. Now, if we would stop here, you would all paskin, you know, unanimously, that a dried up lulav is possible. Don't even dream about taking a dried up lulav. However, Tana, we learned in a brisa, yavesh possible. Okay, that reiterates what we saw in that Mishnah. But Rabbi Yehuda Machshir, Rabbi Yehuda allows you to fulfill your mitzvah with a dried up lulav. What's this all about? How could Rabbi Yehuda disagree on such a fundamental principle? In fact, how does the Torah describe an esrog who remembers? Pre-eights hadar. Hadar means it's got to be beautiful. It has to have moisture. It's not dried up.
That's an
etrog.
Yeah.
Oh.
No, but
so that's going to be the issue. Omar Rava. Rava says the following. Machlokes belulav. The whole debate here between the Rabbanon and Rabbi Yehuda only relates to what?
Lulav.
A dried up lulav. The Rabbanon savri. The Rabbanon hold it just like it says with regard to an esrog pre-eights hadar. And then in the next part of the pasuk says kapos tomorrow, which is the lulav, is makshinon lulav li esrog. We have a hekesh in which when two words appear in the same pasuk and they're both halachic concepts, then we have a law of transmutation in which we equate the two, and by analogy any dinim that apply to X will apply to Y and vice versa. And therefore ma esrog, just like in the case of esrog, which the Torah describes as pre-eights hadar, is therefore boi. What does boi mean?
Right.
We require hadar, and therefore if it's dried up and there's no moisture, it's not hadar. Is af lulav so too, by virtue of this hekesh, a lulav is also boi hadar. Rabbi Yehuda Savar, lo makshinon lulav li esrog. We don't have an equation between lulav and esrog. And now Rava finishes it up. Here's the finale. Avol bi esrog, divri akol hadar bi'inon. And therefore, in the case of esrog, where the Torah explicitly requires a pre-eats hadar, even Rabbi Yehuda would admit that if it's dried up and there's no moisture left in the esrog, then it is possible. So take a look at Rashi. Rashi is on the bottom of the Amud when the lines get wider. And Rashi says the following. Lo makshinon. You have that, Rashi?
Third line.
Lo makshinon, the third of the wide lines. Excellent. Lo hukshu, they were not equated lilmod zemizet, to derive one from the other. Now wait a second. Lo hukshu lilmod zemizeh. It sounds like Rashi is referring to some sort of process. You know, there's a process, an event that took place called hukshu. There's an active verb. What do you mean? Why do I need an active verb? I mean, in the pasuk itself, it says both pre-eitz hadar and kapos tmarim. So why don't I just make the hekesh? I don't need you to make the hekesh. I don't need him to make the hekesh. I'll make the hekesh on my own. Says Rashi, lo nitan lidrosh me atzmo. This is not something that's carte blanche that anybody can come forward and decide on his own that he's going to make the hekesh. Why? Because mikol yud gimel midosh haTorah nidreshes b'hen. There are 13 ways in which we derive halachas from the Torah, and only one of them is a carte blanche. Is a tabula rasa that's left for you to decide whether you want a darshan or not. Which one is that? A kal vachomer. You and I would have said that a hekesh, if I decide that there are things that I want to derive halachas from one from the other, they're written in the same pasuk, that for sure I can do on my own. It's even stronger than a kal vachomer. A kal vachomer requires a certain logical application, and you could always come along with a pircha and you could reject my kal vachomer. But in the case of a hekesh, it's right there in the pasuk. No, says Rashi, hekesh requires a mesorah. Mesorah means that I have to receive this hekesh from my rabbi and he from his rabbi until we go back to Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai. And it has the same status as all, we'll call it the other 11 midos haTorah nidreshes b'hem. So now we have 12 out of 13 which require mesorah, and only one lends itself me'atzmo to derive on your own logic, based on your own logic, and that's called the kal vachomer. So if you take a look quickly at Tosfos, Rabbi Yehuda Savar, let's see if you could find that Tosfos, it's like smack in the middle of the page. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Yehuda Savar, lo makshinon lulav li esrog. We don't have a hekesh between lulav and esrog. Pirish bekuntris, Rashi interprets, lo hukshu, we don't have any sort of a Kabbalah on this Hekesh, Lilmot Zeh Mizeh, V'lo Nitan Lidrosh Mi'atzmi Kol Yud Gilu Midrash HaTorah Dreshman Ela Kal V'chomen. Says Tosus V'Tema G'dola Pirusho. His commentary is a Tema G'dola. Tema means it's unbelievably, amazingly difficult to accept what Rashi says. We have a principle of smichus, right? We talk, Rashi, all of his commentary on the Torah always has something called smichus aparshios. When there are two parshios that are one next to the other, then we learn and we derive conclusions one from the other. Afilu smuchin, da'ayim shnei mikros, smuchin zelos. Even if you have two different verses that are contiguous, is nitan lidrosh min haTorah, you're allowed to darshan from the Torah itself. And the Gemara says, "Smuchim min haTorah minayin." The Gemara Masecht Yevamos derives from a pasuk that there is such a green light, a license to derive conclusions in halach from smuchim, from two parshios that are written one next to the other. Says Tosus Kolshkin, how much more so Hakesha? If you have two things that are written in the same pasuk, da'ayim shnei dvarim hamukashim bepasuk echad. So Tosus, you see, why does Tosus want to set up this Kal V'Chomer? He wants to say that if you can darshan smuchin for the fact that two parshios are written one next to the other, so Tosus says, well, how much more so in this case where there are two things, namely Pri Eitz Hadar and Kapos Tvar, they're written in the same pasuk. Tosus needs this Kal V'Chomer because it happens to be that Rabbi Yehuda, not here but elsewhere, has a principle called Lo Darshin and Smuchin. He doesn't accept the whole principle of Smichas HaParshios. So Tosus says, alright, even if you don't accept Smichas HaParshios, when you have two Parshios, two units that are separated as two separate units, but they're continuous, Rabbi Yehuda says you can't derive one from the other. But if there are two things written in what?
In one
verse in the Torah, then even Rabbi Yehuda would agree that you could darshin it. He says, V'yukomakom ba'akesha v'kra modeh. So therefore, we're stuck here, and we don't understand, that we cannot accept Rashi's understanding of why Rabbi Yehuda is machshir a lulav hayovich. If it's a dried up lulav, in the same pasuk that it says kapos tmarim, earlier in the pasuk it says pre-eitz hadar, and if it's pre-eitz hadar, you need hadar, which means that it's dried up, it's pasul, then how much more so a lulav should be pasul by the same hekesh? So Rashi says, well, he didn't have the hekesh, meaning he never received it. Why do you have to receive a hekesh? It's no worse than smuchin. And not only that, it's a lot better than smuchin, because in the case of smuchin, you have two different units, and you want to put them together. The Sfasema says something amazing here. He says that according to Rashi, the opposite of the Kal V'Chomer is true. It's much more difficult to derive A from B if they're both written in the same pasuk. What sense can you make out of this Sfasema? Again, the Sfasema is hard-pressed. He's trying to defend Rashi. Rashi says that according to Rabbi Yehuda, a lulav hayavesh is not going to be derived from Pri Eitz Hadar of Esrog, and that's because Rabbi Yehuda had no Kabbalah. He never received this Hekesh. So Tosus says, well, why can't he derive the Hekesh by himself? And it's even better than Smichas HaParshis. Comes along the Sfasemis, and he says that you can have an issue about whether comparing and making an analogy between two different Parshis, but if it's in one Pasuk, then Rabbi Yehuda would certainly say you cannot derive a Hekesh. Isn't that, as Ben says so well, counterintuitive?
No,
good. Menachem or Michael?
But if it's a Roshova, you have to have it handed down to you. That's correct. So with a Hekesh, it's not the same thing?
That's the issue. Well, Rashi says that it's the same thing as a Gzeira Shav. And just like in the case of Gzeira Shav, you have to have a Kabbalah, and it goes back to Moshe Rabbeinu.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So Kamsul Tosa says, wait a minute, we have a principle which the Gemara derives in the Masechet Yevamos. It's called Samchinon Darshin and Smichus HaParshios. So we have two Parshios that are written one near the other. We always equate them. That's the principle. You see that Tosus quotes it from a Gemara at the beginning of Masechet Yevamos. Gemara actually has a source in the Torah for this concept called Smichas HaParshios.
It's not one of the 13
It's ironic.
Right. It goes even beyond the 13 right. Minos. It's like saying Teich. Teich means I look at a Pasuk and I translate the Pasuk. That's not one of the Yud Gimel Minos that Torah addresses me. A drasha means when I derive something that's not explicit in the Torah. And Smichas HaParshios is an open, you know, carte blanche that always gives you the right to determine that these two parshas have to be equated. So Tosa says, if in the case of Smichas HaParshios you don't need a Kabbalah, you can derive logically on your own reading of the text halachic conclusions, then how much more so if they're both written in the same pasuk? Comes along with Svasevis, and he says, it's just the opposite. In Yiddish we say, Pumfaken. If it's written two things in the same pasuk, that's worse. And that's where Rabbi Yehuda, according to Rashi, does not derive a hekesh logically you'd have to have. Does anybody want to take a stab at this, Menachem?
No.
I'm looking for an answer, not a question. No, you know, then you can ask me a question.
Yeah, okay. There's logic to that, because Rachmana made a smicha, let's say, of Parshas Ishas Yifetor and Ben Asan Snua. So we learn from that. But then, if Rahman wanted us to learn in the same pasuk, then he would have said, "Pri Eitz Hadar, v'kapot Marim Hadar."
Oh, excellent. I would say slightly different, but you hear what Menachem is saying. If two things are written in the same pasuk, and they're referring, and they describe two objects, then the description that's common to both should be written in such a way, the Torah formulated, that it would be crystal clear that that descriptive term relates to both of them. So the Torah could have either started with the word Hadar and then gone on to Kapos Tomorrow pre-Eitz, or the Torah could have started with pre-Eitz and then Kapos Tomorrow and then put the word Hadar. But in any event, the Torah should have structured and formulated in such a way that the Hadar is clearly Ol Al Shteyan, that Hadar is an introduction to the four meaning. But instead, the Torah describes and defines the Esrog as Hadar. And therefore, Rabbi Yehuda says to use the word Hadar, which the Torah singled out and designated for what? For the Esrog, and apply it to the Lulav, for that you have to have a Kabbalah. But how does Tosis interpret this Gemara? Vishema Kosovar. Take a look at the last line in Tosis. What does Rabbi Yehuda hold? That Lashon Hadar, that lo shayach lashon hadar ela b'peros. The esrog is unique amongst the four minim because it's what? It's a fruit. It's an edible. It's not just the vegetation. The other three are vegetations, but I wouldn't try eating any of them. You know, you might get a pretty bad stomach. So the word pri is designated for the esrog exclusively. It comes along Rabbi Yehuda, and he says that the term hadar only applies to a pri. And the other three minim are not called peros. There's a brilliant breakthrough here of Tosis. So Tosis is hard pressed to understand why Rabbi Yehuda limits the word hadar and that descriptive term to the esrog. I mean, why not apply it straight across the board? All four minim are written in the same pasuk. The answer is take the four minim and divide them into two fundamentally different categories. One category are vegetation, the other category is peros. And you will never find the term hadar to describe vegetation unless it's a pri. And therefore you have no right to take that extra step and apply the principle of smichus. A brilliant chaf, except for one thing. The Svasemis proves from all over the place, all over Tanakh, that the word hadar applies to non-edibles and to other vegetations. So if we had time, or if you come back at 11:45, we'll discuss the Svasemis. What time is it now? Oh, we have one more minute? So just let me see where we're up to, because otherwise I'll forget for tomorrow. Let's see. We're up to Aval b'esrog divrei hakol hadar b'inon. You have that line? Aval b'esrog divrei hakol hadar b'inon. Now, Rabosa, just as an introduction, the balance of this sugya is a very fascinating sugya. The Gemara is going to attack two principles or two premises of Rava. Number one, Rava's premise that lulav, according to Rabbi Yehuda, does not require hadar. We're going to see a number of cases where Rabbi Yehuda disqualifies a lulav, albeit not a lulav ayavesh, but other types of lulavim, and presumably, like a lulav without an agad and so forth, is Rabbi Yehuda says it's possible. So obviously Rabbi Yehuda accepts the principle of hadar with regard to lulav, whereas Rava says that that Rabbi Yehuda rejected hadar and lulav. And then the Gemara is going to attack Rava from the opposite perspective. you're telling me that Rabbi Yehuda would agree that an esrog requires hadar? I'm going to prove to you that Rabbi Yehuda holds that even an esrog doesn't require hadar. So that's going to be the two-pronged attack that we're going to pick up Ritz Hashem. I apologize about the heat, Neil. We'll work on it.
In spite of the fact that their example, Suyem says their examples of their hogar is applied, but in this particular case, you can distinguish between the esrog, which is a fruit, and the other three, which is vegetation. So you could say, okay, hogar is only being applied to esrog because it's different than the other three.
You're excellent, Don. But the only problem is, read the Tosus. Tosus says, lo shayach loshan hogar el beperus, which means literally that you cannot find the word hogar unless you're talking about a pen. That's the problem.
He went too far.
He went too far, exactly. If he had said what you said, Don, we'd be okay. So we'll try to prove the heat situation. I apologize. You know.
Buying tickets for
you, saying okay?